This is The Think Tank with Dr. Mike O'Neill, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
Our guest today is one Marty Schulz. Welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
We have two audiences today. I think half of you who've been in the Valley for over 10 years will probably say, Marty Schulz, wow, I haven't heard from him in ages. I wonder what he has to say now that he's unleashed and unconstrained. Of course,
I'm unleashed and unconstrained because I retired from Pinnacle West and APS, and then we started a law firm, and I retired from that. So, I'm enjoying grandkids in Arizona and Phoenix and maybe a little travel in a bit.
My favorite guests are recent retirees. They are unleashed and unconstrained, and yet they've been around recently enough that they still know something of relevance. Of course, the other half of our audience who's been here more recently is probably going to say, who the hell is Marty Schulz? Hopefully, but in the first few minutes, we'll figure that out. Some years ago, we did an Arizona history series with historian Jack August, Phoenix 40 founder Dick Mallory, Fife Symington, DeConcini, and Dennis DeConcini, and others. Marty should have been on that list, but you're still working and probably not as candid as we hope we'll get you to be today.
Well, I'd like to believe that when I was working, I was candid as well, but I totally understand what you mean.
I mean, you were working for somebody and they had a perspective, and you know, there's a certain constraint that goes with that.
There is a constraint, and you know, you also have an obligation to the person you're working for. I'm sure every employee understands that.
Absolutely, you're ethically obliged to act in their best interest. Though it's interesting, and I think different people doing that stretch that in varying degrees. And you were one of the you had integrity, and therefore your word around this town meant a lot.
I'll just soak up that commentary and let other people make that judgment.
Well, just to bring the second group up, the more recent migrants up to speed, you've worked with about eight governors going back to Jack Williams, who I'm sure almost nobody remembers, Raul Castro, Babbitt, Symington, Brewer, Hull, Napolitano, and Doug Ducey. And I don't know if I missed anybody there, but Rose Mofford, I don't see her on that list, but I'll bet she was there.
Yeah, actually, I had some early experiences with before Raul Castro and before Jack Williams. Jack was the first that I ever met in his office. I was really surprised that he had an eye patch, because prior to that time, he was really a radio personality to so many of us around here. I had not met him personally until that date.
That was a little before my time here, but I heard him referred to as One Eye Jack.
They called him that, but I didn't really focus on that until I met him. And he's actually a great soft-spoken individual.
Well, later on, we're going to get into your work at APS and some of the recent APS controversies. But you were corporate relations. That translates in common parlance to lobbyist. And I don't know if I ever told you this story, but I always used to have a quiz that I would offer to people, and they always thought that I was going to hit them with a punchline, but I said, no, this is seriously. And you have a group of people in a room, and it's all politicians and one lobbyist. And how do you tell the lobbyist? You know the answer to that?
No, I don't know the punchline.
Not a punchline. It's serious.
Serious.
The
okay.
lobbyist is the most likable person in the room, because he has to be if he's going to do his job.
No, I agree with that. On the other hand, I wouldn't get too far into that likable, because if a lobbyist, somebody who is registered to represent a client or a company or an entity or an interest, if that lobbyist is doing their job, then they should have a little backbone and be able to face the appointed or the elected officials and say, I agree with that for the following reasons, or I disagree with that for the following reasons, and have facts and some data at hand. Because if they do that, their credibility increases manyfold.
And your observation, this gets to kind of public perception of a lobbyist. What's the relative importance of persuasion and argument versus campaign contributions in terms of a lobbyist being effective?
Personally, I would say the effective lobbyist is like 90% of the equation, and the campaign contributions are generally a ticket in the door. And when you get individuals that are maxing out at several thousand dollars or more, or raising much more money, that individual may be the principal, but when it comes down to it, he is not the individual who is going to have the most weight over time on many, many issues. So I believe it really is integrity and knowledge about the issue, and then your ability to persuade and deal with the other side of your advocacy.
I wanted to ask, you were involved, among other things, with starting the Phoenix 40, Valley Leadership, and other organizations.
Right.
A word or two maybe on what is the Phoenix 40, again, for some folks who haven't been around here that long. And then I'd like you to segue, if you would, into where you think leadership stands in this community. John Talton, the columnist who used to be here, still has his heart in Phoenix and writes about it, once described the Phoenix 40 more recently as, and this is not an exact quote, but it's pretty darn close because it's stuck in my mind, the once powerful but now toothless and largely ineffectual and irrelevant Phoenix 40.
Well, let me start with a little bit of history. In fact, we were a town and a state that was controlled by what they called charter government. It was like Tammany Hall of Arizona, where you had a few individuals, and I'm going to name them, and then one of them you're going to say, what? Okay, people like Gene Pulliam, who
newspaper
and the newspaper, Arizona Republic, and the Phoenix Gazette. Yes, folks, there was once upon a time an afternoon newspaper called the Phoenix Gazette. And this was replicated around the state in Tucson and to some extent in Flagstaff. But in central Arizona, Tom Chauncey, who was famous for being part of that power structure.
Owned a television station.
Owned a television station. And in those days, it was a CBS affiliate. Now it's the Fox affiliate, Channel 10. His partner, and people do not remember this, but it's fascinating, and was a big player as far as influence is concerned, is the ever-famous Gene Autry. Seriously, Gene owned not only the television station along with Tom, but he owned land, which is now Scottsdale Road and Frank Lloyd Wright. It used to be horse farms, and there's still some horses and in other interests out there, but it's really car dealerships now. And his son, Tom Chauncey Jr., is still in town, practices law. But those individuals really controlled a lot of the thought and a lot of the political processes. And when there was a real effort to reform the town, the then leaders, a gentleman named Keith Turley, for example, who has since passed away, and many others.
Turley was APS.
He was APS and eventually was the creator of Pinnacle West. Correct. And he and some others saw that there was a need for leadership, and they began to pull together structures. But before that, it was the then mayor, Tim Barrow, who I worked for. I worked for John Driggs as his chief of staff, Tim Barrow, and then Margaret Hance. I worked for three mayors. It was Tim really who confronted this leadership structure, the Tammany Hall of Arizona, and said, this is not acceptable. And they came up with ideas to bring more people in and to actually communicate with more people around the valley and beyond Phoenix and even the state of Arizona. And that was the beginning of the Phoenix 40, which morphed into various organizations, which now is called Greater Phoenix Leadership. And along the way, Keith and others had the good sense to say, let's set up a training program or a program to give younger professionals in all walks of life, nonprofit as well as the corporations and the development group and what have you, an opportunity to learn about what's arts and what's transportation, what are the fundamentals of building a community. And that was the beginning of Valley Leadership, which I was pleased, along with some of my colleagues, to literally create the agenda for and the details around what is now called Valley Leadership. And I think they used to call themselves by the Roman numeral Valley Leadership 1 or Valley Leadership 2 or V for the Roman numeral, which was 5. But that has immersed, I think they're over 30, 40 years now. Yeah. Those classes are quite effective because they do bring people together and give them a chance to taste and experience leadership and everything that goes into it as far as the policy and the issues are concerned.
Full disclosure, I was class X. That was the Roman numeral for 10.
I was class V after helping create it and do the due diligence. People were having fun and getting a lot out of the experience. But the sordid detail, and you say the sordid detail, once upon a time.
Can we hold the once upon a time till the break? We've run over a little bit, more than halfway. We'll be back in just a moment with Marty Schulz talking about leadership in the Valley.
The Think Tank. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We're talking with Marty Schulz about leadership in the Valley, where I rudely cut you off due to, well, we got to pay the bills here. Having paid the bills, I want to return. You were talking about leadership in the Valley.
So as we evolved through the 80s, 90s, into the 2000s, we now have a group called Greater Phoenix Leadership. That's one, but there are also many other chambers of commerce. There's also advocacy organizations set up through government, like organizations at the state level, the Arizona Commerce Authority, which really works to create and develop businesses around the state. And I mention that because we are so diverse in this state, fortunately, because we have so many more people who have so many more jobs and business interests. Remember, in the early days, that would be in the 60s, 70s, 80s, the technology was not prominent. But nowadays, not only is technology prominent, which allows for Zoom, for much more communication, some of which is effective, but you can also get under people's skin and be critical through technology as well. And then, of course, technology in Arizona is a huge industry. Once upon a time, it was the early days of Motorola. Now, it's a whole variety of major entities, whether they're the Zoom Corporation actually coming to town and bringing 500 engineers to the iterations of Motorola and other things. But as far as leadership is concerned, I'm personally disappointed. I'm sure that I'll be criticized for this, but that won't be the first time and it won't be the last time. I'm disappointed that we don't focus on the data which suggests certain kinds of policies. And those policies are tough things. Whether you're talking about viruses of these days, what is the data from the medical community? Or you're talking about schools. Schools, you know, we always want to, in our heart, give teachers the front line of education more money. But the school funding formula that we have doesn't really allow that. But people go ahead and pontificate and say, I'm going to put, you know, another $1 billion into education. That's fine, but with 227 school districts, the way it all works, those teachers do not get anywhere near amount of money that they were promised either by their leaders or by some of our politicians. And that's got to change. And I wish that the leadership in Arizona, the business leadership and the nonprofit leadership and the others who are really interested in improving education would sit down and examine the detail and ultimately come to the conclusion that we've got some reform to do before we're going to get results.
You know, you mentioned a number of names involved in the formation of the Phoenix 40, and I recognized all those names as community leaders. If you were to ask me currently who are the people like that in that position, I'm going to draw a near blank. Who are the leaders in the community now?
Well, I'll mention a couple of names because of their unique relationship. A lady named Sharon Harper has been very close to major projects and major political people like Senator McCain, like the current governor, Doug Ducey, and a number of important activities. She's the lady, she's a developer who is developing Park Central, develops Sky Song, but somehow she finds the time to stay in the middle of funding education to the extent possible, to doing a number of other things that are good for the state. So she's one. Former mayor of Tempe, now is head of GPL, Neil Giuliani. He is, you know, the executive leader of the group. And there's emerging leaders like the new leader at Arizona Public Service Company, Jeff Guldner. And I could go on and on. There are quite a few folks, but they tend, instead of be generally leading a group of people or on an activity, they're doing special projects out of their passion and out of their analysis of what's good for the community.
We got just about a minute here. My sense right now of GPL, and of course, Neil is a staffer, so he has to take directions, though he has a lot of status independently. My sense is that they're stymied by the fact that half of them want to do stuff and the other half just want to keep taxes low.
I would say that's probably partially true, but I'd say generally it's an unfair rap on the business community and the taxpaying community. Let's face it, we all would like to keep taxes low, but at the same time, those persons who articulate that position say, but I want to improve education. And our problem right now is that we don't have enough juice, and that we is whoever these individuals are, to pull parties together and say, okay, cut the crap. Now, let's get on with the detailed analysis to come to some conclusions that are going to make the kind of change that we need. And I really believe that that kind of leadership is necessary.
Well, we'll pick up this discussion. We'll talk, near and dear to your heart. We'll talk about some of the recent controversies surrounding APS, because I promised we would do that when we return after break in the Think Tank.
The river run, let all the dreamers wake the nation. Come, the new Jerusalem.
The Think Tank. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We're back talking to Marty Schulz, among other things, and probably you're most well-known for having been corporate vice president at APS for many, many years. Well, since you retired from there, what, maybe was that 5 to 10 years?
Believe it or not, it was 10 years ago.
Time flies.
That's what I said. I was with the company for 32 years before retirement, And I got to tell you, it was the growth years of Arizona, of the Phoenix metropolitan area, of the APS service territory. And those were good but tough years because we were building, for example, the nuclear power plant, Palo Verde Nuclear Power Plant. And what a godsend, what a difficulty in building it over those years. And it is costly. But now it is essentially the saving grace of power platform in Arizona. It's 30% of the power. For APS, it's also the key to how we're going to get to Jeff Guldner's objective. He's the head of APS, and that is to go carbon-free utility. Can you imagine that by 2050? Which
I heard that by 20. That is an ambitious goal, and usually that's the kind of goal you hear from people on the outside saying you have to do this. Of course, they're not the people who have to figure out how to do it.
I'm going to put the pressure on my friends at APS, and they'll probably call me after listening to the show and chew me out, but I can take it. And I think I should say this. I think Jeff is so focused and so talented, as are the people he works with, they can beat that goal.
You know, I think of that statement as analogous to when in 1961, John Kennedy said, we'll get to the moon by the end of the decade. At the time he said that, the technology to do that did not exist, but it's pretty hard to get somewhere unless you have a goal.
I totally agree. By the way, this is not just an isolated PR stunt. The technology exists in many aspects of what will be the applications in the future. For example, the Palo Verde Nuclear Power Plant is there producing every single day a lot of power for this region, and 30% for APS. The new technologies with solar, including the application of large-scale solar, is there. The batteries, which means you're going to store power and use it during the off times when you don't have sun, is not as effective as it will be in the future.
That's really the laggard technology, isn't it? We generate solar pretty well, but storing it is another matter.
Yes. But, okay, I think you have to take a look at the sum total of the technologies that are used. For example, over the years, transmission and distribution lines, many of which are underground, are improved in terms of their efficiency. Solar has improved as it relates to its efficiency. We have improved the buildings that are more effective as far as using energy wisely, and it goes on and on. So this isn't about one size fits all. This is about a whole series of technologies, some of which are not invented yet, but I guarantee, and I'll pick on ASU because I happen to have an affinity for them, they have so much work in the way of research there that it is in my mind a surety that they will be, that means locally, will be a contributor to the overall goal of being carbon free by the middle of the century.
I want to move us back to a period, I think it's after, I know it's after you left, but not in the last year or so. APS is a private company. Because it's a monopoly, it's regulated by the Corporation Commission. It has elected commissioners. This differs from SRP, which most people don't realize is basically a government entity that has elected people. It doesn't have stockholders. Over the last several years, APS was involved with dark money campaigns to elect favorable Corporation Commission members. This, I think, struck most people as unseemly at the least, and of, if not illegal, at, I think most people reacted by saying, well, it should have been. How can you have a company controlling the election of those who are going to regulate it? I couldn't have seen that happening before. I wonder if you could comment on that whole period.
Well, as I understand it, and you're right, I wasn't there, but as I understand it, the company, or at least individuals who were responsible for funding political campaigns got involved with the Arizona Corporation Commission, whether it was what they call independent expenditures or some efforts to make sure that candidates that they wanted were supported. Having said that, I'm not going to defend it because it's not defensible, but that era has passed, and it's been made very clear by the board of directors of Pinnacle West and Arizona Public Service Company, by the current administration, Jeff Guldner and others, Daniel Fretcher, they're not going to be involved in this. And it's clear that election agencies and others who pay attention to this are oversighting them either officially or unofficially to make sure it doesn't happen again. So that was then, and this is now. And it's a two-way street, by the way. The company was established, and they are an investor-owned company, but they also serve over a million customers in Arizona, and they really do serve this economy. So while they are regulated, and it seems like in so many facets of the business, it's up to the commissioners, and I would appeal to them, and I don't represent APS or SRP or any utility. I would appeal to the commissioners in many regards to be less political and more data-driven or analysis-driven. In other words, more thoughtful, because they also have a big responsibility too. And it isn't beating up the CEO or criticizing the company in a political sense. It really is analyzing what's going on, and then making comments and ultimately rules and regulations to correct any deficiencies. But also, where there's opportunity, for example, to invest in carbon-free generation, because that is a goal that Arizona should embrace, it's up to the commission to facilitate those investments when they have the authority to do so through rates and regulations. So it's a two-way street, and as a citizen, I'm going to advocate that.
When you say carbon free, in this context, I don't think anybody's going to build another nuclear power plant. I think, wasn't Palo Verde the most recent? I mean, even though it's almost aged out of its original life, isn't that the newest power plant nuclear plant in America?
As far as one that's operating, I believe you're right. Yeah. But wait a second. Let me tell you, I'm not convinced that nuclear is not going to be a mainstay, a significant part of the energy mix in America in the future. And the reason is, A, the new technologies and the improved technologies that have been installed at Palo Verde in its lifetime. It's not static. It is improving all the time, every day, improving the efficiency, improving the new technologies that are applied to Palo Verde. Those are readily available. And frankly, it's going to come to pass, in my opinion, that nuclear is going to be a significant part of the mix.
Well, it already is. Are you saying that we will continue the plants we have, or do you see new plants being authorized? Because I understand that's a regulatory morass.
It's a regulatory morass, but it's not impossible. And I, for one, would be positive about nuclear. I would be positive about solar, especially large-scale solar. I'd be positive about battery technology. And frankly, from a customer standpoint, that's both residential and commercial, I'd be really bullish on we individuals, doing a better job, a more effective job of reducing our consumption, if you will, and using electricity wisely.
Reduced consumption is the cleanest form of energy there is.
And even though there are obviously, today and in this period of time, we've got temperatures over 110, we use a lot of air conditioning. We use lighting, but we use it more effectively. Now, we also use computers and technology, which is a significant contributor to the increase in usage. So,
well, yes and no. If I use a computer all day, and as a result of that, I don't commute to work, that may be a net energy saver, even if I'm running juice at home.
And that, of course, now we're talking energy broadly too, because if you're at home, like so many people are with their concern about their health and the virus, which is totally understandable, they're not driving around. So you may have a different view of transportation and the use of transportation and its role in our society. So we're thinking differently, and that's good.
That's our segue. We will talk about transportation and other issues when we return for a final segment with Marty Schultz.
The Think Tank. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We're back in a final segment with Marty Schultz, who has been involved in way too much to cover it in one show. He's been involved with public education and finance, school finance, human services, water, and we teased with this, so we'll start with this one. Marty was involved with transportation issues ranging from our streets and freeway programs to the most recent iteration, which finally included light rail as part of the transportation package. I'm looking at our current situation. We're all, a lot of us anyway, ensconced at home. And our eyes, which we thought would be packed forever, are from time to time, we're seeing relief. We wonder if that might be, if more people work at home, maybe this will de-stress some of our transportation needs.
Yeah, I think that transportation planners and those that think about how it's used are thinking that it's possible that some of the stress could be alleviated. My personal opinion is we are going to go back, at least in the short term, after we've got this health issue under control, we're going to go back to pretty much the way we were in terms of school and work. Now, having said that, I'm not saying that there won't be many people who are still working from home or schools that may be on virtual status as opposed to in school. That debate's going to go on for a good deal of time, maybe a year or so. But in the end, we're able to adjust our transportation system. The good news is we've now got a basis for it. We've got a freeway system that is darn good. We've got a major streets program that's good, except for that pothole that's, in front of your house or on the street that you drive. And we do have the beginnings of a light rail. And I say the beginnings because in order for it to be maximally effective, it's got to extend beyond Phoenix to cities in the west part of the valley and continued activity of construction and usage in the East Valley and now going to South Phoenix. So the future is very bright in that regard. And we're capable of walking and chewing gum and whatever phrase that you want to use. In other words, multiple activities, thinking ahead and making adjustments as appropriate.
I look at what has happened with the light rail corridors that we have right now. Of course, there's the Roosevelt Row Central Phoenix corridor that is completely evolved that whole section of town. Now, ASU has a whole lot to do with that as well. But if you were to go out along the Apache Road corridor through Tempe and Mesa, you see redevelopment. I think the next leg going into South Phoenix may be transformative along Central Avenue.
Well, I surely agree. And now that is a slog, if you will, a difficulty, because the business owners along the route, you know, are going to say, hey, this transition's tough for us.
Oh, the transition will be a bear. That will not be pretty.
Maybe more difficult than the transition that occurred along 19th Avenue from Camelback all the way to Dunlap. And now there'll be a transition, if you will, additional routing all the way into Metro Center and beyond. Having said that, look, we've been fortunate, you and I and many, many others, to see this in our real-time lifetime happen. And this is just more good stuff, if you will, that can come as we're the fastest growing, from an economic standpoint, community before the virus hit. And, you know, I believe that we're going to be the top two or three in the country afterwards. So I'm bullish on the future. I think people should be. And it's very encouraging.
Well, the other thing I wonder about is the extent to which this whole work from home situation may cause a lot of people to rethink the nature of work. And I can see a lot of companies saying, let's look at our entire workforce. Some of these folks seem to be more productive from home. Not necessarily everyone. There's some benefits to being in a physical environment you share as well, but there's other places where that's not the case.
Well, the good news is that we're clear-eyed about what's happening. And hopefully we don't get too emotional, but we stay our analytical course and make the best decisions. I'm talking to companies or the educators. The education side of this is huge. And what they're doing at ASU and U of A and NAU, Grand Canyon and others, universities, to intensively plan to figure out what's best for the students and what's best for education. It's fascinating, but you know, it's transformative when they make the right decision. So I'm encouraged. Yeah.
One big quickie proposal I'd sure have. I think every school kid in the state should have a laptop, and we should ensure that there's some sort of internet access as well, because this may go on for longer than we would like.
But let's, when we do that, let's make sure that it isn't all government, the schools that are giving these to the students, that there's some effort at the student level, notwithstanding the difference in you know, economy between the rich kids and poor kids.
Yeah, I mean the rich kid, the middle class kids already have laptops, but there's some areas where they don't.
Now,
we're out of time. I will have you back if you'll come. We have a new feature this week, a guest commentary. This week, Julie Earfley shares her thoughts.
George Floyd's murder has proven to be a wake-up call for many white Americans. We're finally talking about the structural inequities that exist in education, housing, and criminal justice. Companies are promising to diversify workforces, invest in and promote more minorities. And while many of these businesses and organizations will follow through, I also believe some are co-opting the moment in an attempt to garner positive PR while continuing past discriminatory behaviors and policies. Case in point is the powerful business organization, the Arizona Chamber of Commerce and Industry. Last month, the chamber's president, Glenn Hammer, was appointed to the U.S. Chamber's Task Force on Improving Racial Opportunity. That's a real head-scratcher considering Hammer's track record on policies such as public education. Here in Arizona, we lead the nation in the largest funding gap between schools serving predominantly white versus non-white students. That's right. We're number one for funding discrimination, and not by accident. The Arizona Chamber led many of the budgeting gimmicks and policies, such as test-based funding, private school tax credits and vouchers, that led to our state's shameful distinction. The Chamber has also been a cheerleader for regressive taxation policies that place a heavier burden on low-income residents, the majority of whom are people of color. Commitments to racial equity also ring hollow when you endorse bigots, which is what the chamber did when it recently endorsed Jay Lawrence, a state representative with a long history of racist comments, and Sylvia Allen, a state senator who fears decreasing birth rates by white moms and an America that may soon look like South American countries. We should also question the chamber's stance on initiatives. They've chosen to oppose the ballot initiative that would legalize recreational marijuana, even though our state has some of the harshest marijuana penalties in the nation. In 2016, the chamber claimed its opposition was because of a lack of protections for businesses. As a result, the updated ballot measure added safeguards for employers and stronger enforcement provisions for law enforcement. But now the chamber claims marijuana legalization will result in more harm than good, which runs counter to data showing the very real harm criminalization poses to minorities, especially Black Arizonans, who receive average prison sentences for drug offenses that are more than 50% longer than those for whites. The chamber is also sticking with the status quo on education funding, voicing its strong opposition to Invest in Ed, which would give underfunded schools hundreds of millions of dollars for teacher pay and student support services. It seems racial equity and economic inequality are buzzwords for the Arizona Chamber, mere phrases sprinkled into press releases, but never actually considered when endorsing or promoting policies and candidates. And that's why those seeking change should be extra leery of anything the chamber promotes. For the think tank's commentary, I'm Julie Earfley.
That was Julie Earfley with her perspective. Guest commentaries are invited. If you have thoughts you'd like to share, send me an email at O'Neill@O'NeillResearch.com. Include a proposed script or an audio clip would be even better. We'll be back in the think tank next week.
Come, the new Jerusalem.